Just while people are returning to their seats, I think you'll agree with me what a wonderful pleasure it is to have the Parents Association members showing such great hospitality here at St. John's. And I'd like to thank them on behalf of all of you here for the effort they've gone to providing what they have. Yeah, thank you for that, because I agree. And the moment, you know, when we were first organising this and approached them, they didn't even hesitate. Yeah, no worries. Yeah, yeah, we'll be involved with that. So it was great. It wasn't sort of like, oh, I don't know. So I really appreciate their help. Also with Mother Calisteni and the sisters for bringing the books and various other things. If you didn't see anything, by the way, that you're hoping to find, I'm sure if you aren't aware of it, that the sisters may have other things that may interest you, maybe something on the topic, for example, or something else that you may want to know. And I'm only saying this because someone did ask me earlier about a particular type of thing, and I said, well, if you speak to the sisters, maybe they can get it for you if they do have it. Okay, let's continue then. We come to perhaps one of the saddest chapters of the church's history, what is referred to as the Great Schism. The word schism comes from a Greek word again. Remember that movie, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, where the father always said, you know, that word comes from Greek? Well, you'll hear me doing that a lot too, but it does. It means to tear apart, to tear apart, and the great tearing apart. So this chapter covers the period of towards the end of the 8th century, right up until the early 13th century AD. Now, what had happened through this history from about the 8th century or so, there was tension developing between the Church of Rome and the other Eastern churches that we looked at earlier, the five ancient patriarchates: Rome, Constantinople, Alexandria, Antioch, and Jerusalem. Very important to know those in the order of honor. Okay? Constantinople was placed second in honor because it was New Rome, the new capital of the empire. So it had a primary position after Rome. So this tension was developing at this time. And the reason for there's a lot of reasons for this, but basically one of the main reasons between the tension developing in the churches, firstly, it was jurisdictional. You see, what had happened is that gradually the Pope or the Bishop of Rome saw his position as being more as having or needing to have jurisdiction over the whole church, what we refer to often as papal supremacy. Whereas the Eastern churches back then and still today, and when I say Eastern, I'm referring to the Orthodox churches as we refer them today, believed, as we noticed at the beginning of the establishment of the church by the apostles, that although all the apostles had an equal mission given to them by Christ. Actually, one thing I forgot to mention earlier, the reason why they're called apostles, it comes from the Greek word, see there I go again, the Greek word apostello, I send out my representatives. If a king or a leader in those days wanted to send out a representative to another country to pass on a message on behalf of the king, well, they sent out apostles, apostello, I send out someone. So the apostles are called that because they were sent out by Christ to the whole world. So each apostle, however, had his own, let's call it jurisdiction, his own mission given to him by Christ, and that's why they scattered it, went to different parts of the then world. And so the Eastern churches at the time then, as we still do today, believe that the Bishop of Rome, yes, had a position of honor, first among equals is the term that was used and still is used for our ecumenical patriarchate, which I'll explain shortly, but not to have jurisdiction over the whole church. His jurisdiction is in the Western church, the whole church governed by the jurisdiction of the Church of Rome. So this was a creation of the tension between the churches, this change in papal supremacy. Now, theologically speaking, there's that word again, filioque. I'll explain it next week. But this was one of the main theological tensions or disputes that arose. And when I explain it to you next week, I think you'll understand better why it did become an issue for the Eastern churches and why it still is an issue for us today. Now, there was also communication issues. I mentioned earlier that the universal language in the early church was Greek. Now, by the beginning of the 4th century, Latin had become again in the West the first language, so much so that there were very few people in the western part of the Roman Empire by the 4th century who knew Greek, very, very few people. And also in the eastern part of the Roman Empire, there were very few people who knew Latin. So there was this communication breakdown by the 4th century onwards where they couldn't communicate anymore on that common universal language. And as you can understand, that created some growing tensions. One aspect of church history here that really drives the point home for me was the reality that in the 4th century, 5th century or so, St. Augustine, one of the early bishops of the church, wrote a treatise on the original sin in the West in Latin. Around the same time, St. John Chrysostom, based in Constantinople, was Patriarch of Constantinople, wrote also a treatise on the original sin of Adam and Eve in Greek, and both of them went two different directions in their expression of original sin and consequently affected the belief and understanding of the fall of Adam and Eve, which we'll discuss in the third session, in different ways, because they wrote not only in different languages, but they couldn't communicate to share and debate, perhaps, you know, aspects of this matter of faith. So the communication breakdown was added to this tension as well. There was also cultural differences which created the tension. I mean, you only need to go to Istanbul today compared to Western Europe to see the great cultural divide there now, let alone back there in the ancient world where travel was so much harder. There was also political tension, and one of the greatest things that happened, there were many political issues, but one of the greatest was this. 800 AD, Pope Leo III, Bishop of Rome, crowns Charlemagne, who is the leader of the Franks. Remember them? Okay, he's the leader of the Frankish barbarians who took over the western part of the Roman Empire. He was leader of that barbarian tribe. Well, Pope Leo III crowns this guy on Christmas Day, 800 AD, as the Emperor of the Holy Roman Empire. That's what he called it. Now, the problem with this is there was an emperor sitting on the throne of Constantinople who happened to be the emperor of the Eastern Roman Empire, or Byzantine Empire as it became known. So there was a tension created by having two emperors now in opposition with one another, and what made matters worse is a bishop of the Church of Rome crowned him. So you can see how that created tension, great tension, from a political move that Charlemagne had pushed through. Now, it was also at this time, not to just give you only bad news, I'll give you some good news, that the conversion of the Slavic people, they were a barbaric tribe, remember, no written language, who in 863, two brothers from Thessaloniki, Cyril and Methodius, two saints of our church, the church of St. Cyril Methodius, just down the road here. I don't know where I'm pointing, but it's around here somewhere in Preston. That way. You're pointing up, Nick. Yeah. That's the upper Jerusalem. Yeah. St. Cyril and Methodius. Now, these missionaries of the church are amazing. If you ever read the life of these saints of the church, it's an amazing story. Let me give you a very brief rundown. They were Greek speakers, you know, writers and readers. They traveled to the northern regions above Greece, where the Slavic people were situated, the Slavic tribes. They lived with the people, got to know them. The people got to know them as well. They learnt their language. They learnt their culture. They learnt about their various religions and things that they believed in. They settled with these people. They were loved by these people. And eventually, what did they do? They created a written alphabet for these people. Now, I don't know about you, but how do you do that? How do you go into a tribe that you learn their spoken language, they don't have a written language, you create a new alphabet for them, okay? It's called the Cyrillic script. It's the language of the Slavonic people today, and that's why if you look at Russian and Serbian written languages, you'll notice there are Greek letters in there. The reason being that St. Cyril and Methodius used a Greek alphabet to create this new alphabet. Now, if that wasn't enough, wait till you hear the rest of it. They then proceeded to translate all the Bible and all the liturgical text of the church into this new language that they had invented. How do you do that? They did it. It was a miraculous thing. I don't know how anyone does that, but they did it. And that's the amazing thing of these saints. There was tension created by these people too, by the way, because at this time, Latin missionaries from Rome also went to this region. And what did they do? They insisted that the local Slavonic tribes learn Latin. And they insisted that they read the Bible in Latin and celebrate their Mass in Latin. Whereas Cyril Methodius said, no, that is a heresy to insinuate that only Greek, Hebrew, and Latin are the holy languages is a heresy, they actually said. So they actually went to the Bishop of Rome, St. Cyril and Methodius, and appealed to the Pope, and the Pope agreed, yes, these people should have their Bible and their services in their own languages. And that's what the missions of the Eastern churches have been ever since. Australia is different because we're a migrant church. We'll talk about that later. Okay? But when a church was established in a new land, it was always taught in the language of the people. Let's move on. Russia is converted 988 AD after a flow on from not only Cyril and Methodius but various other things that happened. Now we move on with the Great Schism. 1054, there are excommunications that occurred which widened the gulf between the Church of Rome and the Eastern churches. Now if you look at any history book on the church's history, you'll notice that most history books will tell you that this is the year that the break, the schism between the Church of Rome and the Eastern churches actually occurred. That's not really true. This was a major event, but the real split was a gradual tension that grew from the 8th century and finally did not sever until 1204, which I'll mention very shortly. So think of it as a gradual separation. It wasn't like a sudden event that just ended it all, okay? And what happened here, I'm not going to talk too much about 1054 because all history books write about it, but very simply and very basically, through a representative, the Pope excommunicated the Patriarch of Constantinople. And the Patriarch of Constantinople said, you can't do that to me, I'm going to excommunicate the Pope. So both bishops of Rome and Constantinople excommunicated, which basically means kick them out of the church, it's a simple way of putting it, each other. They excommunicated each other. Okay, that's what happened at 1054 that really created, what many historians say, the split between the Church of Rome and the Eastern churches. But really it's a very great widening of the gulf at that point. Now, if you didn't get anything that I've said so far, this is the most important part of tonight. For the first 1,000 years of Christian history, basically and generally speaking, and simply put, okay, because we spoke about other schism and heresies before, but generally speaking, the church was basically visibly united for the first 1,000 years or so of its history. So think about that. 1,000 years of virtual visible unity. For the last 1,000 years, there was the great schism between the Church of Rome and us today, as in the Eastern churches. Okay, so this visible unity, and I've got an icon here that for me just says it all. This is the Orthodox icon of St. Patrick of Ireland. He is an Orthodox saint. We celebrate St. Patrick's Day. Why? Because he is a saint of the early church when we're all visibly united as one church. This icon for me says it all. And he lived, as you can see, towards the end of the 4th century through to towards the end of the 5th century. Now, this is perhaps not just one of the saddest times of church history. This is going to be one of the saddest events of human history. You've probably heard of the Crusaders. The Crusades were basically armies that were mustered up by the church in the West and the leaders of the West. When I say that, based in Rome, in what we call in modern day France, Spain, all those areas there in the western part of Europe. Basically, they got armies together, which they call the Crusades, because by then, Muslim tribes from the East moved across and took over Jerusalem and what we call the Holy Land. And these people there in the western part of the empire said, no, we can't tolerate this. We've got to do something about it. So they mustered up these armies and they sent them across to Jerusalem and the Holy Land to capture back all these places, the holy sites in Jerusalem and other places that had fallen to the Muslim tribes that had come across. Now, the Fourth Crusade in 1204 stopped over in Constantinople. And what they did, they ransacked the place. They slaughtered people. They desecrated churches. It was horrific. If you ever read the history books of what happened, this really tells you how bad it was. It was so bad that a commentator of the time in Constantinople wrote in a historical account that it was better to come under the occupation of the Muslim tribes who at least respected our religion. Because I don't know if you're aware, in the early stages of the Muslim tribes, they actually respected Christianity and they actually referred to Christians as the people of the book. So they had a certain respect. They allowed them to believe what they wanted to believe. They didn't hassle their religion. That was the early stages. Later things changed with different sultans, of course. But this commentator said it was better to fall under the sickle of these marauding Muslim tribes rather than these barbarians with the cross of Christ on their shield, who were just so barbaric in their approach and how they treated us. So it's a very sad state of... And the other thing that really underlines for me a lot of the things that went missing at that time, you've probably all heard of what's referred to as the Shroud of Turin, which is often referred to as being the burial cloth of Jesus. Now, that was in Constantinople and was taken from there, among many other things, at the time of Constantinople. And historians have actually documented that from the time of the sacking of Constantinople in 1204, this disappeared, together with other things. I remember once we were talking with our bishop here in Melbourne, Bishop Ezekiel, and he happened to mention that one day around Christmas, he watched the high mass of the Pope John Paul at that time in the Vatican doing Christmas midnight mass. And he noted, maybe from photos he must have recognized it, he noticed that the chalice that was on the high altar at that time at that Christmas mass was one of the chalices that were taken at the sacking of Constantinople. So I don't know how he knew that. He probably saw it in a photo of a catalogue or something. I don't know. So the sacking of Constantinople in 1204, this becomes the final straw of relationships between the Christians of the West and of the East. This was the final straw. It was really the completion of the schism. Now, this is a mosaic of the Fourth Crusade, which was, as you can see down the bottom here, it was made in 1213, 9 years after the desecration and sacking of Constantinople, which would have been very fresh in the minds of the people still at that time, 9 years after. And this is a mosaic that was found there of the sacking. It's a very moving mosaic, although a very primitive mosaic, a very moving one where you see the person putting his hand out and the other about to clobber him with a sword. A very moving mosaic for me. Okay, what is the result of the Great Schism? Well, it resulted in what we now often refer to as the Western Church. Now, don't be confused by that term. Today, when we refer to the West, we're usually talking about America and Western Europe. What we mean here is the Western part of the Roman Empire, okay, of that early history. So the church of that region. And it was based in Rome. It was the political establishment of that empire with the crowning of Charlemagne. It was named the Holy Roman Empire, at that time. We often refer to it today as the Roman Catholic Church, which is its proper name. Here in Australia, Roman Catholics often refer to themselves as Catholics or the Catholic Church. Their full title is the Roman Catholic Church. I don't say that as a denigrating term. I'm just saying that's the reality. Their head bishop is Rome. Okay? Their head bishop is not Melbourne. Archbishop Dennis Hart is simply a figurehead here in Melbourne. The real bishop of the Church of the Roman Catholic Church in Melbourne is not Dennis Hart. It's the Pope. He is the head bishop of the church in Melbourne. And so the church is the Roman Catholic Church. And often it's referred to as the Latin Church, for obvious reasons. Now, the Eastern Church, it's referred to the East because it's the eastern part of the then Roman Empire, consisted of, and still consists of, the four ancient patriarchates still united in the one faith, centered in jurisdiction. In the political realm of the Byzantine Empire or the Eastern Roman Empire, based in Constantinople, it's collectively referred to today, the Orthodox Church is collectively referred to as the Eastern Orthodox Churches. Okay, you'll hear these terms mentioned, and you may even hear Greek churches. I remember some years ago meeting a Lebanese man, and we got talking, and he was telling me that he's Greek Orthodox. And I said, "Do you know Greek?" He said, "No." "Are you born in Greece or of Greek descent?" He said, "No." "Maybe way back?" "No, no Greek connection at all." "Where are you from?" "Lebanon." I'm scratching my head thinking, how is he Greek Orthodox? I found out later, years after, what he actually meant. You see, the other Orthodox churches who often refer to themselves as being Greek Orthodox, what they're really saying is this: I'm Greek Orthodox, meaning I'm not Latin. I'm not a Westerner, I'm an Eastern Christian, is what they're really saying when they're saying I'm Greek Orthodox. I'm Greek Orthodox as opposed to being a Latin Christian. I'm a Greek Christian, an Eastern Christian. That's where that term often is used. Now, just to give you a picture of where this schism occurred. Now, it wasn't a razor-cut clear line down the middle, but if you can imagine sort of a rough line down between here, this part here, and notice that this part of Great Britain is included as well, is what we might call the Western Church, based in Rome, and all this region here, including this northern region of Africa here, is what we may refer to as where the Eastern Orthodox churches were established at this time of the Great Schism. Now we come to another sad chapter of human history, but also of the Eastern churches. Eventually, the Muslim tribes move further from the east towards the west. And in 1453, they actually capture the city of Constantinople. So now, this Christian city under the Eastern Orthodox churches becomes a Muslim city. I don't know if you're aware, but when the Anzacs fought at Gallipoli, it's very apt since it was Anzac Day the other day, when the Anzacs fought at Gallipoli, it was still known as Constantinople. It was only named Istanbul very shortly after World War I. Okay? So it was still known as Constantinople when the Anzacs... So if you read any documents of the Anzacs writing back to Australia, they would refer to Istanbul as we know it today as Constantinople. So it was used as the name of the city for a long, long time. I have been told, I don't know how true it is, that Istanbul, the name Istanbul, is the Turkish word for Constantinople. I have heard that before. Now, it's this time that the Ottoman Turk Muslim occupation grabs hold of not only Constantinople, but other regions. Most Orthodox nations, if you can call them nations at this stage, are occupied by the Muslim Turks. Greece, as you may know, for 400 years was under occupation, roughly. Russia, however, is not occupied. And even though all these other Orthodox nations come under occupation, Russia is free from that yoke and so considers missionary activity and actually starts to send missionaries around the world. That's when the church in China is established. Hands up how many have never heard that there's an author that the Orthodox Church was established in China in 1690. Just a show of hands. How many are hearing it for the very first time? Okay, nearly half of you. This is an icon of the martyrs of China, of the Orthodox Church in China, who were killed at the time of the Boxer Rebellion that occurred. And it's a beautiful icon. I love the little children at the front. Aren't they cute? Yeah. So the church was established in China in 1690, roughly. In Alaska, 1794, Saint Herman of Alaska establishes the church there. Show of hands, how many people are hearing for the first time that many of the natives of Alaska, that we sometimes refer to as the Eskimos, are actually Orthodox Christians? Yeah. See, you really know your faith well, don't you? I specifically chose these to emphasize that point, so don't feel bad. Because when I first heard about it was when I was at theological college, so I only learned about it recently too. But it's an awesome reality. See, we think of Orthodoxy as just being, you know, Greeks, Serbians, Russians, you know, because we're more prominent, particularly here in Australia. But the Orthodox Church is around the world in many different nations. The church in Japan was established in 1871. St. Nicholas Kasatkin, he's a beautiful figure of the missions. Even St. Herman, I didn't say much about him, but if you ever read about these people, how they actually met these people, they went and lived with them. They got to know them and love them, and the people loved them in return. St. Nicholas of Kasatkin, who was the first bishop of Japan, is a perfect example. He was a Russian missionary, went over there, settled, he was a monk, settled with the Japanese people, didn't say a word about his faith, just went and lived as a monk, as an Orthodox Christian in their midst. Got to know the people, got to know the language. He didn't go there to convert people, okay, to win people over. He just went to live with the people. He lived with them, okay? Now, after a while, a war broke out between Russia and Japan. All Russians were ordered to leave Japan. St. Nicholas was allowed to stay. He was that much loved, not only by the general people, even the authorities loved him. He knew their language, their culture, he knew their religions. He sat and ate with the people. He just knew them very well. Eventually, people started to come to him and say, "What's this stuff that you believe?" People eventually, after years, came to him and wanted to know, "What is this stuff that you believe in?" And eventually, St. Nicholas went back to Russia, got together a printing press, a whole lot of literature, started to translate stuff into Japanese, went back over to Japan, and then started to teach the people about Orthodox Christian faith. And in 1871, he went there. This is the Cathedral of the Holy Resurrection in Tokyo. It's still there, by the way. It's had some damage through earthquake, but it's been rebuilt. It was built between 1884 and 1891. And this is the first national Japanese bishop of Japan in 1941. Bishops previous to him from St. Nicholas until 1941 were Russian nationals. But from 1941, the bishops, now a metropolitan in Tokyo, based in Tokyo, have been national Japanese people. We now come to the Protestant Reformation, which is a period of history of the early 16th century. Now, it was brewing earlier than that. This is Martin Luther. You may have heard of him. He was actually a Roman Catholic monk. And Martin Luther protested about so many things that were happening in the Roman Catholic Church at the time. And as a Roman Catholic, did not particularly want to leave the Roman Catholic faith, but rather wanted to try to reform the Roman Catholic faith or church from within. Eventually, however, he was excommunicated by the Roman Catholics, and he basically went off and established what we now call the Lutheran Church in his honor. So Martin Luther, he was the first one to really be a prominent figure, but there were people before him that were, this tension was brewing in Western Europe before Martin Luther, but he was a major figurehead. Now we come to the Church of England, where Henry VIII, the King of England, if you ask anybody, how did the Church of England get formed in 1529, most people will say to you, well, Henry VIII just wanted to get married again, and the Pope wouldn't give him a divorce, so he left the Church. That's not fully true. That's part of the story. There's a lot more to it than just that. And I say that because King Henry VIII was actually a very devout Roman Catholic. Okay? And the only reason he swapped wives so many times wasn't because he just got sick of one and he wanted another. He needed an heir to the throne. Okay? So there's a lot more to it than just he wanted to dump a wife and get another one. Okay? I'm not suggesting that what he did was right, by the way, but anyway. But I just want to emphasize to you, there's a lot more to the Protestant Reformation and what King Henry VIII did than just how people would express it sometimes. Anyway, because of this, Henry VIII eventually establishes in 1529 what is referred to as the Church of England. Now, here in Australia today, this church is referred to as the Anglican Church. It was originally established in Australia as the Church of England, but now we tend to call it the Anglican Church. Whereas in America, the same church is usually called the Episcopalian Church. So if you ever hear of these terms, they're all the same church. It's basically the Church of England established in different places. They wanted to get away from the name England, so they changed the name, basically. So this is a continuation of this Protestant Reformation. In the meantime, there were some Roman Catholic developments as well. In 1854, a dogma, a teaching, was proclaimed by the Pope at that time of the Immaculate Conception. Most people misunderstand, even a lot of Roman Catholics don't know what this means, but if you're a Roman Catholic, you must believe this teaching in order to be saved. That's what a dogma means in the Roman Catholic tradition. You must believe this in order to be saved. And what the Immaculate Conception is the belief and teaching, which we Orthodox don't accept, that the Virgin Mary was born without the consequences of the original sin of Adam and Eve. We're going to talk a little bit about what that means in 2 weeks' time. But we do not accept that. We say that although the Virgin Mary was sustained sinless throughout her worldly life, okay, and she was kept free from sin, and she refrained from sin throughout her human life, however, we would accept that she was born with the fullness of the consequences of the fall of Adam and Eve, just like every single human being has. That's why on the 15th of August, the Roman Catholic tradition actually celebrates the 15th of August what they call the Assumption of the Virgin Mary, which means that she was assumed to heaven body and soul, as they would believe, without dying. But in the Orthodox Church, we actually refer to the 15th of August as the dormition of the Holy Theotokos, the kimisis, the falling asleep, the dying. She physically died, just like Christ physically died, just like we physically die, she physically died and then was assumed body and soul to heaven. Okay, so that's a major difference between teachings of the Roman Catholic faith and the Orthodox Church. And notice, this is a very new dogma, 1854. Now, along comes another dogma, a bit later than that, which is even more devastating towards the schism. It's actually pushed us further apart than what we were with the schism. And that's the dogma of papal infallibility. Again, as a Roman Catholic, you must believe this in order to be saved. And what this dogma teaches is that the Pope, whenever he proclaims teachings of the church ex cathedra, as it's referred, as in his position as Pope in the church, okay, he is infallible. He can't make a mistake, a very simplified way of explaining it. Okay, we Orthodox would say no one individual is infallible, no matter how holy, no matter how great. We would say, however, that the church is infallible because the church as the body of Christ, all the members together, not one bishop, not one patriarch, not even just simply a council of bishops, because even councils of bishops have been shown to be wrong at times by the church and by the illumination of the Holy Spirit. However, the church as a whole is infallible, guided by the Holy Spirit. But one individual, we would say, is never infallible. Even the fathers of the church on their own, one father cannot be considered to be infallible, no matter how great this father is. OK, Okay? We always speak of the consensus of the church fathers, not one on individually on their own only. So that's what happened over the last couple of hundred years that really drove the wedge even further for us after the Great Schism. Here's a summary of everything we've spoken about tonight. Let me explain that you have a timeline down the bottom here, which shows the continuation of time, and on a horizontal plane, but on a vertical plane, we show the moving away from the true doctrine, this change to doctrine. And this is in effect what's happened historically and pictorially. In the first roughly 1,000 years of the church's history, there was a visible unity. The church was fully visible united. It still is, by the way. Christ established only one church, and it was visibly fully united. Along comes the Great Schism with the Crusades. We're told here, by the way, as a footnote, that Pope Benedict VIII mandates celibacy for priests, you know, compulsory celibacy, soon after the schism. The Roman Catholic Church, we see there's a division here with the Great Schism. Along 1517 comes Martin Luther, launches the Reformation, where groups break off and splinter off from even one another. 1529, the Anglican Communion breaks off as well from the Roman Catholic Church by Henry VIII's approval and sanction. And we see here, this is, by the way, why there are thousands of groups in the world today calling themselves Christian. Okay? That's why. So basically, if I can put it in a very simplified form, in the world today, anyone calling themselves Christian means one of three things. They mean either that they're Orthodox Christians, or that they're Roman Catholic, or that they're Protestant. Now, we bunch anyone else who's not Roman Catholic or Orthodox into that broad umbrella that we call Protestant. Now, everyone's in there, properly speaking, in one sense, although Anglicans may not be keen on the idea, but really, we could probably put the Anglicans in the Protestant umbrella as well, okay? Because they're a breakaway from the Roman Catholic Church, in essence. So anyone. Now, within the Protestant umbrella, we could also include some of the sects and cults. I'm speaking specifically of, say, for example, the Mormons or the Jehovah's Witnesses, who really can't even be considered Christian, really. If you look at what they believe, you'll see what I mean. But other than that, we can bunch them all as under the Protestant umbrella. Now, let's move on. In 1821, there's the beginning of the freedom from the Turkish yoke. And that's when various missions, migration, that's what brought us to Australia, in effect, and America and these various other places. There's what we call the ecumenical movement, which is very basically, and simply put, these groups around the world calling themselves Christian, it's coming together and talking, dialoguing. Okay? That's what the ecumenical movement really is. You know, coming together and saying, okay, we know our similarities, but we also know our differences. Let's come together and at least talk. Now, in 1965, in this ecumenical dialogue mode, Patriarch Athanagoras, Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, got together with Pope Paul VI, and they actually lifted the excommunications from 1054. A lot of Orthodox and even Roman Catholics criticized them for doing this, and even today there are quite a few people within the church who would criticize what they did. My personal opinion is they did the right thing. I'll tell you why I say that. Because the excommunications of 1054 wasn't one church excommunicating the other, because some Orthodox have accused Patriarch Athanagoras of how dare he act as a pope of the Orthodox. How can he go and speak on behalf of all the Orthodox? Okay, that's some of the accusations that have been put against him. But the point is, the excommunications was Pope against Patriarch, Patriarch against Pope. So when these two individuals got together and lifted these excommunications, they were lifting the excommunications off one another and their position as Patriarch and Pope. So it was a fine gesture of beginning the ecumenical dialogue. This is an icon that was produced around that time. Saint Peter, you may know, was the first bishop of Rome and considered to be the founder of the Church of Rome, in effect. Whereas St. Andrew, who is his biological brother, St. Peter and St. Andrew were brothers biologically, St. Andrew is accredited as being the patron founder of the Church of Constantinople. So Patriarch Athenagoras and Pope Paul VI meeting is like the two brothers meeting again. That's how it was viewed at the time when this icon was commissioned. Since then, however, there have been other issues. This is a photo from the funeral of Pope John Paul II. Was it 2005 or so, I think it was. And as you can see here, what appears to be an Orthodox bishop sensing the casket and what appears to be an Orthodox deacon present as well. And most people who saw this said to me, "Father, Orthodox took part at this funeral. What's going on?" They are not Orthodox. They are Roman Catholics who are dressed to look like Orthodox. They're what we call uniates. They sometimes call themselves Greek Catholics. They sometimes call themselves Eastern Rite Catholics, Byzantine Catholics. I've even heard Melkites, Maronites. There's a whole lot of different terms that they use themselves. But the term we normally use is uniates. Now, we as Orthodox in the dialogue said this is an insidious attempt at coming together again because it confuses the people. The people see these clergy and these people and they assume that they're Orthodox when they're not. They're actually Roman Catholics who have adopted many of our Orthodox practices. They dress, the clergy dresses Orthodox. Their priests are married, some of them, okay? Where we commemorate our archbishop, they commemorate the Pope, as well as perhaps their local bishop as well. Because basically the main difference between them and us is they have the Pope as their head of their church. Okay, whereas we, as we'll show you shortly, have our local archbishop, but also the council of bishops of the local synod for us under Constantinople. Anyway, I thought I'd mention to you because this photo shows us some of the difficulties that have arisen out of the ecumenical dialogue. So this created tension at the dialogue between Roman Catholics and Orthodox because the Orthodox saw this as an insidious attempt to try and win over Orthodox and say, "Oh, well, they're Orthodox, we just go to their churches, they're doing the same things we're doing, so what's the difference?" Okay, and they're saying, "Oh, no, they're a feature that brings us closer together." That's how the Roman Catholics would view the uniates, that they're between the Roman Catholics and Orthodox, and they're bringing us closer together. Okay, what I'm going to do now, before I end with the history of the Church in Australia very briefly, is run through on a map where all our jurisdictions and churches are located. Firstly, the Ecumenical Patriarch of Constantinople, based in Constantinople and jurisdiction over Turkey, but also has jurisdiction over many archdioceses around the world, Crete being one of them, North and South America, Australia. I don't know if you knew this, but the Church in Australia, the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of Australia, is not under the jurisdiction of the Church of Greece. We come directly under the jurisdiction of the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople because the canon law of the Orthodox Church stipulates that any churches established outside of the mainstream, typical Orthodox countries is meant to come under the jurisdiction of the Ecumenical Patriarchate. The reason why we have the situation today where you have so many different jurisdictions in Australia and not under the Ecumenical Patriarchate is because the migration that brought us all here meant that we all needed specific bishops and clergy that could minister to us. So they come under different jurisdictions. I don't know if I call it a prophecy, but perhaps a prediction is that sometime in the future, might take 100 years, might take 200 years, all Orthodox in Australia will come under one jurisdiction under the Ecumenical Patriarchate, and by then probably will be called the Australian Orthodox Church, eventually. Maybe even eventually with our own synod here. That's what will happen in generations to come. Probably a long time yet. Not in our lifetime anyway. Okay. Now, the Church in Great Britain is also an archdiocese under the Ecumenical Patriarchate, including several of the provinces and the Dodecanese Islands, like Rhodes, in Greece, that come under the jurisdiction. Thessaloniki, I think, is one of the churches under Ecumenical Patriarchate as well. In Europe, we have various metropolises. Actually, it was the previous one. Yeah, the previous one was Metropolis, I beg your pardon. That means basically a smaller church than an archdiocese. That's basically what we mean. So in Europe, we have France, we have Germany, Austria as a metropolis, Sweden and all of Scandinavia is a metropolis under the Ecumenical Patriarchate, the Church of Belgium, the Church of Switzerland, Italy and Malta, the Orthodox churches there come under Ecumenical Patriarchate, Spain and Portugal as well, New Zealand is a metropolis under the Patriarchate as well. Now, in the metropolis of Hong Kong and Southeast Asia, we have China, India, the Philippines, Indonesia, Malaysia and Singapore, and Korea. Now, we have the Church of Mount Athos, the monastic center in northern Greece, is also under the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Constantinople, as is the Church of Iran, the Orthodox Church of there. And I understand that the Church, the Orthodox Church in Iran, has fairly good relationships with the local people and authorities. I don't know how good that is, but that's what I believe anyway, what I've heard. Now, we have the next of the ancient patriarchates, Alexandria, which is based in Egypt, in Alexandria in Egypt, but is also responsible for the jurisdiction of all of Africa. We have the Church of Antioch, the Patriarchate, ancient Patriarchate of Antioch, which is based in Syria and Lebanon, and also has jurisdiction over the Church of Iraq, which I believe has good relationships there as well. The Patriarchate of Jerusalem also looks after the area of Israel and Jordan, and if I'm not mistaken, I think they also look after Mount Sinai. Does anyone know? I think Mount Sinai. Alexandria looks after that. Okay, right. I knew one of the patriarchates look after that. Yeah. Now, the newer patriarchates that were established fairly recent in church history was the Patriarchate of Moscow, which basically looks after all of Russia, the Patriarchate of Serbia, the Patriarchate of Romania, of Bulgaria, of Georgia, a very tiny nation of Georgia, which is a patriarchate. I believe historically the earliest Christian nation of the world, from what I understand in church history. Now, autocephalous churches, basically they're churches that are self-governing. They have their own council of bishops and they elect their own bishops. Okay, they're self-governing, autocephalous, meaning that they are self-governing completely. The Church of Cyprus is autocephalous. The Church of Greece, except for the provinces under the Ecumenical Patriarchate. The Church of Poland is also autocephalous, as is the Church of Albania. The Czech Republic and Slovakia are also autocephalous. We now come to the autonomous churches, which basically means they have some aspect of autonomy, as the word implies, but they come under a mother church, mother patriarchate, but they have some sense of self-governance. Finland is one of those churches, as is Estonia. This is a beautiful diagram I found on the internet, which really helps explain what we just saw on the map. Down the bottom here, it tells us that there's one autocephalous church, Constantinople, which is considered the first among equals, and these numbers here represent all the various metropolises and archdioceses under their jurisdiction. Australia is one of those 27, basically. And you see here a total of 14, including Constantinople, of all the patriarchates and central churches, autocephalous churches, self-governing churches, that are in full communion. Basically, any church that's in full communion with Constantinople is a canonical Orthodox church. So if you ever want to know whether any Orthodox church is canonical, for example, the so-called Macedonian Orthodox Church is not a canonical church because it's not in unity with Constantinople and the other patriarchates and autocephalous churches as well. And we see various other churches there. Yeah, I think you got the idea. Okay, let's go. Now, a brief finish on the Orthodox Church in Australia. Just a few statistics, basically, that I'm going to run through very quickly, and we're going to focus particularly on the Greek Orthodox Church, but a little bit on the Orthodox Church in general. Firstly, The first Orthodox divine liturgy in Australia took place in 1820, and it was on Kirribilli Point in Sydney, which is a very apt place to have the first divine liturgy on Australian soil. The residence of the Prime Minister, I don't know if the new one, Kevin Rudd, lives there at the moment, but I know John Howard did live there. But anyway, that was the point. And what it was a Russian Antarctic expedition who obviously had a priest with them and some vessels, Eucharistic vessels, and they got off the boat and went on Kirribilli Point and had the first divine liturgy on Australian soil. It was in the 1820s that the first Greeks arrived in Australia, and in 1898, in May, the first Orthodox Church in Australia, Holy Trinity, was built in Sydney. Until 1902, priests' service books and sacred vessels came from Jerusalem. The administration and jurisdiction of the church, firstly, Greece looked after this from 1903 until 1908, when the Ecumenical Patriarchate took up its jurisdiction of the church in Australia. And in 1924, the Ecumenical Patriarchate establishes what was then called the Metropolis of Australia and New Zealand. And the first bishop or metropolitan arrives at that time as well. Now, there was some local opposition to this, and that's why some of the churches in Australia today, a great minority, I'm glad to say, opposed this establishment of the jurisdiction of the Ecumenical Patriarchate of Australia and broke away from the church. And here in Australia, you may be aware, there are some churches calling themselves Greek Orthodox that are actually not in communion with the other Orthodox churches in the world, not just in Australia. Okay, so that's what resulted out of this local opposition. So there's a few independent communities. There's a few here in Melbourne, there's Adelaide, and there's currently some in New South Wales too, and a couple of other places. Now, the problem with this is that the clergy, the priests and bishops so-called, are non-canonical. They're not priests and bishops. They may look and dress and talk and do the services like a priest or bishop, but you are more of a priest than they are. Think about this. If leaving tonight, you come across an emergency where someone's about to die and you know that they've never been baptized, you can perform the baptism tonight in an emergency. Okay? And it's a valid baptism. And when that person, if they live through that, come to the church to be baptized, okay, we don't do the whole service because we're seeing them as being, and you have baptized them. But every one of these people that have done any sacraments, they're totally invalid. So you are more of a priest than they are. Think about that. Okay? So all their sacraments and services are totally invalid. 1927, more than 10,000 Greeks are in Australia at that time. The statistics show that in 54, there's about 75,000 in Australia. In 1959, the metropolis here in Australia and New Zealand is elevated, and it now becomes the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of Australia and New Zealand. There are more people here then, and obviously the church is expanding. The metropolitan now is promoted and becomes archbishop. In 1961, there's then about 160,000 Greeks in Australia. And in 1970, for practical administrative reasons, the Ecumenical Patriarchate forms what is now referred to still as the Greek Orthodox Archdiocese of Australia, and also forms what's now referred to as the Metropolis of New Zealand. In 1976, there's about 375,000 Greeks in Australia. In 1981, the census shows 421,281 Greek Orthodox in Australia. I always wonder who that one is. In 86, the establishment of St. Andrew's Greek Orthodox Theological in Sydney in New South Wales, which I placed here in the history of the church in Australia because it's a very prominent event. From 1986, anyone wishing to do theological studies in an Orthodox accredited theological college does no longer need to go overseas. It's all homegrown, in other words. Okay? from that time. And it's a great blessing for us here. And that's why you often hear people referring to this event as really being the establishment, really, of the roots of the church in Australia, having our own theological college. That concludes this evening. Now, I know that you may have some questions and comments. There's a cordless mic that is going to go around, and we have time for questions. Terry, if you'd like to stand so people can see where the microphone is. If you'd like to keep your questions pretty much on topic, if you do have questions that are way off topic, we're happy to speak with to you about those questions. Father Dion's here, and so is Mother Calisteni and the sisters, and there may be a few other people that you know are fairly knowledgeable. Feel free to approach us afterwards and ask us those questions. Yes.
Thank you. My question is to do with your comments about the formation of dogma in the Western Church and its relationship to salvation, in terms of the infallibility of the dogmas that are produced in the Western Church. How has the infallibility progressed in the Orthodox Church from the end of the seventh ecumenical councils?
How do we see within our own church the concept of infallibility? Yeah. Yes, pretty much what I was saying earlier, that the infallibility, we would say, is the church. The church is infallible, being the body of Christ guided by the Holy Spirit. And our Lord has promised us that even the gates of Hades will not prevail against his church. Okay, so that's how we would say it. Now, as far as the Pope proclaiming himself to be infallible, we would say heretical. We'd see that as a very serious proclamation, very serious. And like I said earlier, it really drove a wedge further into the Great Schism, rather than trying to going back to the visible unity we once had. That just drove us even further apart. So we would not accept that dogma at all. If we were, you know, considering reunity tomorrow, let's say, that's one thing that we would not accept. Can I go a step further and say, if the churches were reunited tomorrow, the Orthodox would have no problem in accepting the Pope as first among equals in a position of honor of the whole church, but not as having jurisdiction over the whole church. That's the main difference of how we see papal supremacy. Yes.
So, Father Chris, if there ever was a Vatican III of the Latin Church, do you think the Eastern Orthodox Church would be invited, and do you think they would accept?
Definitely invited as observers. I don't know if invited as participants. I'd say at present, no, that would not happen. But Vatican II, which happened in the 60s, there were Orthodox observers there. I can't remember if our Archbishop actually said he was one of them. He was? So people are nodding their heads. I thought he said that he was there too, but I wasn't. It would have been as a fairly recently ordained clergyman himself. And but so as observers, yes, but as participants, as in voting participants, definitely not now. I don't see that. Not only on the part of the Roman Catholics, but I don't think the Orthodox Church would accept that either.
Είπατε για την Παναγία ότι οι καθολικοί δεν παραδέχονται ότι πέθανε η Παναγία, αλλά ανελήφθηκε. Yes. Αυτό ήθελα να ξέρω, να το διευκρινίσω.
Μάλιστα, αυτό πιστεύουν.
Ναι, αυτό πιστεύουν. Yeah. Αφού εμείς έχουμε, φυσικά, πέθανε η Παναγία και μετά ανελήφθηκε στον ουρανό.
Μάλιστα. Just to, for those who may not have understood, the question was, just to clarify, did we speak of the Roman Catholics believing that the Virgin Mary was assumed body and soul to heaven without dying? And as I clarified, yes, that is their belief, whereas we do not believe. We believe she physically died and then was assumed to heaven. One of the consequences of the original sin is death. So, you know, to say that she did not die, is, you know, that's why they have to believe in the concept of she was free of the consequences of the original sin. Another question or comment, for that matter. Feel free to contradict, by the way. If there's something I said that really rattles you, feel welcome. This is the place in the forum to talk about it. Not that I'm inviting arguments, but anyway. Yeah.
The question, Father, is what is the relationship between the various Orthodox churches in Australia? I know that in the past His Eminence established something called SCOCA, the Standing Canonical Orthodox Church in Australia. Can you please give us further information about what's happening
in one phrase? I consider this is my opinion since you've asked me. I consider our relationship with our churches quite sadly poor. It's sort of pretty much not a surprise that that has happened, because when we arrived here as migrants, what happens when anyone migrates to a new country, they naturally want to clump together with their own. It's security. It's a human thing, okay? And what happened was is we clumped with our own. Our churches became our clubs, okay? We all know what we mean when we say this, and that's what they became. Now, in one sense, there was nothing wrong with that, because it gave support to people and gave them that security that they craved. You know, being able to talk their language and, you know, and all that part of it, and having social structures around their church communities. But unfortunately, we haven't really looked at each other and come together as much as we should have. I believe that's going to start changing. I think it has already started changing. The Theological College has become one of the great mediums of this change, because what has happened already since 1986 is many people of the various Orthodox jurisdictions around Australia have come and studied at this college. And these people are now, some of them already ordained clergy in their own jurisdictions, and they have a contact through the college, and it's bringing us closer together. And I believe as time goes, we will be coming closer together. I welcomed at the early stages of tonight people from the Antiochian tradition. Well, that's one example. You know, people heard through the grapevine that we're having this. And I know that I did speak, and they may even be here, I'm not sure, people from the Russian Orthodox tradition under the Ecumenical Patriarchate of our church in South Yarra, who have showed interest in coming tonight too. So some of you may be here. I didn't meet you. If you are here from that tradition, I'd like to meet you if you don't mind. And so there is a relationship, but in my opinion, not that good. And definitely we could work on it, all of us. We are the church. It is our responsibility to work on this. We have 2 or 3 minutes left of questions before we end the night. But as I said, if you have other questions you want to ask us after this, or you're not keen on asking in a public forum, please feel free to approach us afterwards. We're happy to stay through to 3 a.m. and answer them for you. Yeah. Yes?
Father, did you mention that did you state that all the churches should maybe come together under the Ecumenical Patriarchate, all the Orthodox jurisdictions of
Australia? Well, that's how it should be, and it's not now, and it's probably too early for that to happen right now. Okay, but
why the Ecumenical Patriarchate?
Because that is the central jurisdiction of all the Orthodox churches, or should be, according to canon law, outside of the traditional Orthodox lands. That's how it should be. But right now it can't, because, for example, not fully anyway, that was, Con mentions SCOCA. SCOBA? No, SCOBA's in America. SCOCA in Australia. What that is the canonical Orthodox churches coming together in a form of a forum, a committee, and trying to do things together. Okay. Now, that's limped along for several decades, not really successfully. I won't get into the reasons, but it needs to go a lot better and deeper than that, since we are, after all, in full communion with one another.
Yeah, my question, it doesn't have to do with like the first, like the Russians were first here, they did the first liturgy. It doesn't have to do with who was first here.
No, it's not like you know, the British planting a flag and says we claim this in the name of the Russian Orthodox Church. It doesn't work that way. That's why canon law was established, to have order in the church. Now, there's nothing wrong with migrants coming up over here and having their own priests and bishops to minister pastorally to their own people. That's naturally how it's going to be. Okay, it has to be that way, because, you know, language, culture, the whole bit, it has to happen that way. But eventually, and how many generations going to take, okay, because it will eventually get to the point where none of us Orthodox in Australia will know our native tongues from our migrant generations ever again. Okay, it might take several generations, but it's going to happen. Okay, my own presbytera, my wife, is of Irish, Scottish, English, Swedish background. Now, she doesn't have any of that at all. None of her religious background, none of her language, none of her cultural. It's all gone. Generations ago, it's all gone. Okay, she's Australian. She knows her heritage. She studied it and looked at it. But if she didn't, she wouldn't have a clue. She got a big surprise when she found there was Swedish in her family tree. So, it's, you know, who knows? Only a few years ago, found out that one of my grandfathers who died a long time ago was Armenian. I thought all my my ancestors were Greek. So I'm a quarter Armenian. So if there's any Armenians here, you're in good company. Yeah, so that was a big surprise. Obviously, he escaped from the genocide from Asia Minor and moved across to Greece, met my grandmother. The rest is history, as they say. Yeah. I'd like to acknowledge my auntie here too, who's the child of this grandfather, by the way. So welcome, Athea. I had to embarrass you in front of everybody. So. Okay, another question? One more and then we're ending. If you have other questions, by the way, even next week, keep them. We can talk about questions from this week, if you like, because there will be some sort of connection from week to week.
I just wanted to make a question on the church in Japan and Alaska. Like, is that declining or is it...
I'm not really sure, but Father Emmanuel Lekopandis, who's our parish priest at St. Dimitrios in Muni Ponds, his sister went there recently and actually attended worship there in the cathedral in Tokyo. And just said it was a thriving parish, beautiful service. Actually, you know what you just reminded me? On my phone, I've got a recording of Christos Anesti in Japanese. I'll play it for you just now as we end, okay? So my understanding is that Alaska, I'm not sure. I don't know too much about the church in Alaska. But because it was sold to America, as you know. So I've got a feeling from what the bits and pieces that I've read that it is thriving, but how well, I'm not really sure.
With the saints that took Christianity to these countries, did they become saints after...
Yes.
So are they the latest saints
not the latest. We've got many after them. Saint Nectarios, for example, in 1960 is a good example. They are fairly recent saints, but they're not the most recent. There's much more recent ones than that. Yeah. Okay, we're going to end, if you wouldn't mind standing, because even though you don't understand, it's Christos Anesti, to hear Christ is Risen in Japanese. Christ is risen from the dead, trampling down death by death, and on those in the tombs bestowing life. Truly he is risen. May God bless you and keep you well, at least till next week.